we could fall the rest of the way.
I know that before the night is through, I'll be talking love to you, meaning every word I say.
Was the last time I felt like this, I was falling in love, falling and feeling I'd never fall in love again. Yes, the last time
it's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s. And Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts, hidden gems, and variety that you won't hear on generic classic rock stations. So tune in to the Roots of Rock and Roll, Fridays at 3 p.m. on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every box got a right to be booming, because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every flower got a right to be blooming, because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world.
All the freaky people make the beauty of the world.
Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world.
Welcome, humans. I am ready for you.
Welcome to Neuroemergent. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle, and I am actually autistic. Last month, in the launch episode of Neuroemergent, I talked with consultant Dan Dickinson. He's the founder and program director of Neurodiverse Inclusive Solutions in Salem. I want to thank Dan again for helping me launch the show, and for being so open about his own experiences as an adult diagnosed autistic.
It's painful masking and trying to fit in and trying to be something you're not.
The main topic of our conversation was the language of neurodiversity, and that's the title of our launch episode. But it really is going to be the underlying theme of everything that we talk about on the show, because language is how we shape our reality in large part, and most especially in mediums like this one. So today I want to take a little time to go over some basics, really. What is neurodiversity? What does that mean? And I want to start with a statistic that Dan dropped in our conversation that surprised me just a little bit.
It's businesses that want to present a DE&I atmosphere for their clientele coming in and be an autism neurodiversity-friendly business. Because you're looking at about 15% of the population fits that demographic.
All right, let me stop, slow down, and reverse. You just gave a statistic. 15% of what is what?
So roughly 15% of the population is neurodiverse in some way. You're talking ADHD, autism, and other anything under the neurodiversity umbrella.
So when I went online to find that 15% statistic, I actually found 15 to 20% as a range in multiple sources. But what exactly does it mean to be neurodivergent? Who qualifies and who gets to say? I guess you would say that the neurodiversity movement is a subset or facet of the disability rights movement in general. The term neurodiversity recasts autism, ADHD, dyslexia, and other conditions as natural variations in human neurology, rather than, or not necessarily as, disorders and learning disabilities. In other words, the neurodiversity paradigm challenges the medical or pathological model, as well as the psychiatric profession's monopoly over the power of naming. Nobody owns the idea of neurodivergence or neurodiversity. Does Down syndrome, traumatic brain injury, or even gender dysphoria fall under the neurodiversity umbrella? It depends on who you ask. A narrower definition focuses on the quote-unquote spiky profiles associated with autism, ADHD, and what used to be called specific learning disabilities, dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and dyspraxia, also known as developmental coordination disorder, or DCD. People with these formal diagnoses tend to have areas of great strength, neurologically or cognitively speaking, alongside the deficits that many struggle with. Sort of like superpowers and Achilles' heels.
'Cause I used to be a superhero. No one could touch me, not even myself. And you were like a phone booth that I somehow stumbled into. Now look at me. I am just like everybody. Yeah. I am just like everybody. Yeah. If I was dressed in my best defensive, would you agree to meet me for coffee? If I did my tricks with smoke and mirrors, would you still know which one was me?
You're listening to NeuroEmergent, the podcast about neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. And I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle. In last month's podcast, Dan draws a historical analogy between neurodivergence and left-handedness.
If you were left-handed, you were pushed to not use your left hand. Right-handed was the way to be.
During much of Western European history, left-handedness was literally demonized, and so the left-dominant minority was forced to conceal their unfortunate condition and try to pass as normal. Their struggle to negotiate the physical requirements of a right-handed world caused considerable stress and might easily be defined as a disability. In this example, however, it's the social context that turns a natural variance into disability. And under the neurodiversity paradigm, the same logic applies to autism and to the four Ds, previously known as specific learning disabilities, dyslexia, dysgraphia, etc. Now, I know this doesn't necessarily make for scintillating radio, but in the interest of really understanding things, I'm going to quote a 2020 journal article by Nancy Doyle of Birkbeck, University of London. Quote, "The evolutionary critique of neurodevelopmental disorders is that their perceived pathology is related to what we consider normal in modern times, as opposed to what is normal development within the human species. The conditions are named and identified according to their most prominent deficits, which are themselves contextualized within our normative educational social history. Dyslexia is discovered around the same time as literacy becomes mainstream through education. ADHD becomes more prevalent with the increasing sedentary lifestyles from the Industrial Revolution. Autism increases in line with modern frequency of social communication and sensory stimulation. And DCD, as our day-to-day need for motor control of complex tools and machinery, becomes embedded. Close quote. Now, there are broader, more inclusive definitions of neurodiversity, which I absolutely do not dismiss, but I will be focusing on the podcast on this narrower profile of conditions, in part because that, of course, is my own experience as an adult diagnosed autist, but also because these spiky profiles seem to be related. Not everyone with autism has co-occurring conditions, but most do. They may or may not be learning disabilities. They might be OCD or other conditions.
Autism isn't just like a straight line of less or more autistic. It's sometimes known as like a spiky profile.
So what does the spiky profile mean? The spiky profile really is referring to test scores of various cognitive and developmental abilities. A neurotypical profile is going to look more even. They might be higher or lower on a lot of these particular dimensions, but high scorers tend to score high across the board, and low scorers tend to be across the board. People with autism and people with other related conditions tend to have lots of highs and lows on those scores.
I think it was back in 2000, I want to say 21, they published the term profound autism for the first time. And when it was published, it said someone who's autistic with an intellectual disability.
So the term profound autism is becoming more and more widespread after it was endorsed by an expert panel commissioned by a medical journal, The Lancet, in 2021. This expert commission announced or concluded that it was critical to introduce the term and make official in some way the term profound autism because it identified people who have high dependency needs and are likely to need support throughout their lives.
These are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date.
So in just 4 years, this term has become more used, more officially used. Children with profound autism are the ones that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. described in not especially glowing, human-loving terms. But even without the dehumanizing rhetoric, the term profound autism is problematic because it implies that the high dependency needs of such individuals correlate with the degree of their autism. That higher support needs mean they are more severely autistic. But that is not true. To the contrary, their higher support needs are far more likely to reflect their co-occurring intellectual disability.
Doctor will write a letter to the school, and in that letter to the school will say so-and-so has profound autism. They need 24-hour care. They need all these different things. The parent then reads that, and now they say, my kid has profound autism.
According to the Kennedy Krieger Institute, quote, profound autism refers to a subset of individuals with autism spectrum disorder who have an intellectual disability with an intelligence quotient less than 50 and minimal to no language and require 24-hour supervision and assistance with activities of daily living. Close quote. Crucially, the intensity of characteristics required for an autism diagnosis, such as sensory sensitivities, restricted interests, and stimming, are irrelevant to whether someone's autism is deemed profound or not. How does that make sense?
Being autistic and a low IQ doesn't mean you're more autistic.
One unfortunate side effect of misleading linguistic shortcuts like profound autism is that autism and intellectual disability are now being conflated to the point where the word autistic has become a schoolyard insult.
We limit vocabulary, and we take away words for something, and we don't replace them with something else, society will.
That's right. Autistic is the new R word.
So we used to categorize special ed. The R word was somebody with an intellectual disability that wasn't otherwise explained, but it was somebody who had an intellectual disability, and typically someone with an IQ under 70 or under 50 or under 40 was the thresholds. And that was used, that word. But now we're not allowed to use that word, and there's no word to replace it. What I've actually found is in a junior high, high school, middle school, the term is autistic. They will mock someone and be like, what, are you autistic or something?
It's exactly what I was getting toward, because you can change the language, but the stigma's still there, and so the stigma will attach itself to the supposedly unstigmatized language, and there's, like, that's a constant process that's always happening.
Let's see. I was 4 years old, and they tried to test my IQ. They showed me this picture of three oranges and a pear. They asked me, which one is different? It does not belong. They taught me different is wrong. But when I was 13 years old, I woke up one morning, thighs covered in blood, like a war, like a warning that I live in a breakable, takeable body, an ever-increasingly valuable body, that a woman had come in the night to replace me, deface me. See, my body is borrowed. I got it on loan for the time in between my mom and some maggots. I don't need anyone to hold me. I can hold my own. I got highways for stretch marks. See where I've grown. I sing sometimes like my life is at stake, because you're only as loud as the noises you make. I'm learning to laugh as hard as I can listen, because silence is violence, and women and poor people. If more people were screaming, then I could relax. But a good brain ain't diddly if you don't have the facts. We live in a breakable, takeable world, an ever-available, possible world, and we can make music like we can make do. Genius is in a backbeat, backseat to nothing if you're dancing, especially something stupid like IQ. For every lie I unlearn, I learn something new. I sing sometimes for the war that I fight, because every tool is a weapon if you hold it right.
That was the great Ani DeFranco performing My IQ from her 1993 album Puddle Dive. This is volunteer-powered, listener-supported KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Volunteer-powered means we make the content. Listener-supported means you pay the bills. To help pay the bills, you can donate at kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. And if you're still using snail mail, you can send it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Welcome back to NeuroEmergent. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle.
Why can't we see your face?
They're about to show it. Keep watching.
So, do you remember when Disney decided to do a live-action remake of The Little Mermaid starring Halle Bailey? In viral videos, young black girls cheered to see a Disney princess who looked like them.
She's like me!
Then the adults joined the conversation.
If anything, I mean, not only should the Little Mermaid be pale, she should actually be translucent. They have no kind of pigmentation whatsoever.
Of course the Little Mermaid is black, all right? Everyone whose name starts with Lil is black. Lil Wayne, Lil Nas X, Lil Kim.
You are pandering to black people. If we want to give the public representation, we can create another original black princess.
Conservative podcaster Matt Walsh, Comedy Central's Trevor Noah, and rapper slash YouTuber Long Beach Griffey were among those weighing in on the representation debate back in 2019. My name is Carrie Stewart Lingle. I'm an award-winning journalist and cultural critic, and I know what it's like to wait and wait and wait to see your story, your identity, represented in arts and entertainment.
No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened.
If you love superhero movies, maybe Black Panther or Wonder Woman finally made you feel seen.
He knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage it's made. We just assume that it happens. No one else is in the room where it happens.
I worked as a professional theater critic for more than 10 years, but it wasn't until earlier this year that I really felt like I was seeing my story on stage, even though it was also the story of a Latina scientist who works in a zoo.
I arranged the meeting, I arranged the menu, the venue, the seating,
but no one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the party gets, yes, the pieces that are sacrificed in.
Welcome back to NeuroEmergent. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lingle. So, in a previous life, I was a theater critic. A professional theater critic. Now, that is an incomplete job description of what I did as a journalist in Arizona for 25 years. But when I moved back to my native state of Oregon last year, even though I was no longer professionally required to see theater, I definitely wanted to check out the cultural scene in Portland. And earlier this year, I had the privilege to interview playwright Diana Burbano about the world premiere production of her play Sapience at Artists Repertory Theater. Diana was also diagnosed with autism as an adult. And this production was a pretty big deal for the neurodiverse community in the theater world, just as in Hollywood and in every other part of our culture. Representation has been a huge debate and focus for the past decade or two. And let's just say that up to now, the representation of neurodiversity in our popular culture has not been super accurate. Diana Burbano is a Colombian immigrant, best known for her play Ghosts of Bogota. And I'm going to play you some excerpts of our conversation about how autism and neurodiversity have been represented in the theater and pop culture.
Let me tell you what I wish I'd known when I was young and dreamed of glory. You have no control.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Jefferson.
I give the closing number in Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda's revolutionary Broadway musical, is Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story? But the real question he's asking of audiences and theater makers across America is who gets to tell whose story? That question is all the more urgent in 2025 for obvious, historic, unprecedented reasons. Diversity, equity, and inclusion may be dirty words at the Kennedy Center these days, but representation remains a central concern in the theater, which is, after all, an ancient representational art form. My name is Carrie Stewart Wengel. I'm a journalist and cultural critic. And 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and ADHD. I'm on a call today with playwright Diana Burbano, whose new play, Sapience, puts neurodiversity in the literal spotlight. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you, Carrie.
Can you give us a brief preview? What will audiences see and hear?
Well, Sapience is the story simply of a primatologist and her orangutan. The story is about how we communicate, how people communicate with each other, and what different methods of communication work and don't work, and how not everybody communicates the same way. The primatologist is a person who, on the autism spectrum, who spent their entire life masking it and hiding the truth from other people.
I'm very curious. The fact that the protagonist is on the autism spectrum, just from your script alone, I would call a spoiler. And yet you have chosen to include it in this interview like that. To me, that's a big moment in the play. But I'm curious about the choice to name or not to name.
Oh, that's really interesting. You know, I never actually thought of that would be a spoiler. I don't know, because to me, it seems so... For me, as somebody who is like Elsa, who is on the autism spectrum, it seems so obvious, but maybe it isn't obvious, and maybe that's kind of the point. I kind of thought people would know. And maybe that's kind of what the character, if the character doesn't know or doesn't perceive it, or if it was like my experience growing up, it's like, well, it's impossible. You're too smart. You're just lazy. You're distracted, you're not, you could do better, you can do much, much better. And so I think that leads you to believe that you just have problems, you're not, you know, that there's some, what's wrong with you is your own bad habits and things like that.
I really did read that, the script, as intending for that to be a big reveal that surprises at least some of the audience members, at least, you know, those who aren't familiar with the neurodiversity dialogue, I guess.
You know, you make a very good point. I always assume people know more than I think that sometimes they do. I do, because especially about things that I'm sort of obsessed with. So, but it's interesting. What does the general public know, and how do they know it?
No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
Was primatology an interest you brought to the project, or an interest that you researched specifically for the project?
Oh, I researched it specifically for the project because I heard a story on NPR about a orangutan who was trying to, who was speaking to their keepers. And I thought that would make a really interesting story. This play started out in a writer's group where we had a chance to interview experts, any experts that we were interested in. And I thought, well, I'm really interested in writing about autism, and I'm interested in writing about this orangutan. So why not, let's get a primatologist in. And I got both my experts on the same day. And what you're supposed to do is interview them both. And, they were so interested in each other, they ignored me and started talking about behaviors and started talking about all sorts of things. And I thought, God, that's fascinating. They're so interested in what each other has to say. And my primatologist was, again, one doesn't want to diagnose people, but, you know, I thought, oh, interesting. I did a lot of research about orangutans and a lot of research about how they're great mimics. They really want to be like human beings. They, especially when they're kept and sort of isolated with and away from other orangutans, they decide that humans are sort of their troop, and they do their best to mimic us. And so that also felt somehow right. Like, when you're masking, what do? You mimic. You do your very best to try and figure out, well, what's normal, and how can I be as normal as possible so that people don't think I'm weird.
Talk less.
What?
Smile more.
Huh.
Don't let them know what you're against or what you're for.
I would like to, what your thoughts are about how autism and neurodiversity have been represented in the theater.
Curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, I thought was really, really interesting, and it approached it in an interesting way. Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes it's a little bit like being Latino. You see it, but you're not quite sure it's exactly what you recognize as what's real. You know, and then there's the TV shows that are always coded, right? Like Hugh Laurie in House is so coded, and there's that other, lots of criminal finders are coded.
Yes.
In that way. Sherlock yes, Holmes, classically.
Starting with Sherlock Holmes, I read an article recently that called those the gifted eccentric trope. Mm-hmm. And for sure, that is part of the things that are coded that way, even unconsciously. I definitely was interested in Curious Incident. I do think that was a very interesting portrayal as well. And also very interesting in that author's choice to never explicitly say autism or Asperger's or anything like that mm-hmm. in that novel. Young Sheldon, do you know Young Sheldon and mm-hmm. Big Bang Theory?
Yeah.
I'd like to make a sandwich, but I'm out of bread.
So they make a very clear decision to not explicitly name Sheldon's clear autism, but they are clearly consciously dealing with it.
There's some in the fridge.
You shouldn't keep your bread in the refrigerator. Staleness is caused by crystallization of the starch molecules, which occurs faster at cool temperatures.
On Earth, we'd say thank you.
Like, there's this very particular decision to not name it in a lot of these things, and I'd like to know what you think about that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how I feel about that. Except that it just sort of goes to prove that it's more common than people think it is, and that we're still afraid of naming things out loud, and somehow the naming of it means that the person. I don't know if it does. It mean that if you name it, it's that you're admitting to some kind of a quote unquote flaw, or is it that if it isn't named, then it can be a quirk and an eccentricity and not something that is a, again, quote unquote disorder disability, right? I mean, isn't right. it much more fun to be eccentric? Are you less special because it's a diagnosis rather than a quirk?
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes to a lot of really strange and interesting places about how we perceive ourselves and how we would like to be perceived, how we name things, how we name ourselves, and how what things are called is very important, especially getting labeled. And again, in this society now, it feels dangerous a little bit. Like, it feels dangerous.
Every other founding father story gets told. Every other founding father gets to grow old.
When you're gone, who remembers your name? Who keeps your flame? Who tells your story?
Who tells your story?
So Elsa says, people on the autism spectrum are naturally selected adaptations, humans cognitively suited for solitude. And my question is just, do you believe that?
I believe that it's an adaptation. I do. I don't believe in solitude as much. I think Elsa's trying to convince herself because she's so lonely that's what the truth is. But I think I feel like, again, it's different for everybody. Some people are okay on their own. Some people crave the company. It's all different. Mm-hmm. It's always different. As about 12 years old, there was a lot of going to psychiatrists and things like that to try to figure out what was wrong with me. I was not diagnosed then, but I was constantly put into therapy, and there was all sorts of speech therapies and all kinds of things to try and get me on track, but no formal diagnosis until I was quite a bit older, which is like within the last 10 years of both autism and ADHD. It helps to know, but it also... it grieves me because I see how much it has helped my son to be diagnosed early. And I just wish I had had some of that grace myself growing up, because I wasn't a straight A student. I couldn't concentrate yeah. in school. And I think I graduated in the lower fourth of my class. I mean, it was a disaster.
I don't know if that grace would have been available to you then. When I was diagnosed at age 49, I thought that must be an incredibly rare thing. No, actually, there's more and more.
Mm-hmm.
I read recently, and I did not know this, that Steven Spielberg was diagnosed with dyslexia in his 60s.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So,
I have no idea. My son is on the autism spectrum, and when he got his diagnosis, he was relieved. And he was like, okay, now I know. Now I got an idea. What's happening? Now I know. And he was really like, and he was almost like, now I can tell my friends. Now we have a baseline. Whereas when I was growing up, it was such a thing you didn't talk about. It was so shameful. And it was, nobody believed that it was possible for me to be on the spectrum because I was not showing the signs that were so stereotypical that were, you know, Bruno Bettelheim's autism sort of prototype. You know, it's not the same. And everybody, I think the thing people say is if you've met an autistic person, you've met one autistic person, and not everybody is going to be the same at all. So,
well, in particular, because again, the spectrum itself is, you know, it didn't exist until 2013. Mm. You know, before that, you could not, it was written in that it was impossible to be both autistic and have ADHD. You could not have those two co-occurring conditions. And if you did, you would have been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And now Asperger's doesn't exist. and instead we have this other thing with, and you know, in the DSM-6, there will be some other different formulation that we'll all have to come to grips with in some way.
No one really knows how the party gets a yes. The pieces that are sacrificed in every game of chess. We just assume that it happens. But no one else is in the room where it happens.
I'm going to shift gears just slightly. I'm very curious about the casting questions.
Mm-hmm.
In particular about whether you think autistic characters should always be played by autistic actors. I mean, imagine the best case scenario for this play. It becomes a big hit. It starts getting produced by LORT theaters across the country. A lot of those theaters are not necessarily going to be able to find an autistic actor who particularly an autistic Latina actor who could do that role, right? How do you feel about neurotypical actors playing neurodiverse roles given, you know, in 2025, given everything that we've led up to, not necessarily going all the way back to Rain Man?
I'll say this. I've been an actor since I was a very young person. And just this year, I'm going up to Seattle to play a Colombian person for the first time in my life. I used to joke, because I did musical theater, and this was before In the Heights was a big thing, that I did both of the Latino characters in musical theater,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I did them. Got it. That's it. So I've never played Colombian before. And I've spent a lot of time playing Mexican characters. I've played characters from, you know, different countries, but never my own country. But because the paucity of parts is such that I, you know, you feel like, yes, I can take this Mexican character because I'm close enough. And I think it's such a strange and weird place to be because there's not enough roles. And I feel like if there is an actor who self-identifies as being on the autism spectrum, who wants to come in and audition for the part and is Latina, then that role should be theirs. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a great answer for you. It is such a strange and weird, weird thing because representation, it sounds like such a highfalutin thing, but it's literally like, there's just not enough roles. And there are actors in LORT theaters. There are lots of actors all over the place who have auditioned at LORT theaters, have gone to open calls and have tried and tried and tried and have never been cast and then have just given up. And I think when a theater says that they can't find a certain actor, then I think, well, why don't the actors trust you enough to come out? Especially with actors of color. Like, why don't they trust you enough to come out? What has happened to them in your theater that has caused them to go, nope, that's not a comfortable space for me? I think for actors of color, there's just an element of, can we please have something of our own? Can we please have something of our own? I don't want to do a Black Willie Loman. I want to write a character that is equal and as exciting.
Did you know that 80% of KBOO's funding comes from our members? KBOO is a registered 501c3 nonprofit. It is one of the oldest community radio stations in the country at 56 years old,
and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. We here at KBOO Community Radio want to assure our listeners that despite the threat of losing federal public radio grants, we will continue to unapologetically represent the voices of our community and not waver in the face of scrutiny from the government. We are made by people like you, for people like you, and we are accountable only to you. Welcome back to NeuroEmergent. I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lengel. We're listening to excerpts of my interview with playwright Diana Burbano from earlier this year. A Colombian immigrant best known for Ghosts of Bogota, she wrote Sapience based in part on her own experience as an adult diagnosed autistic. Sapience joins a small but growing collection of plays exploring neurodiversity, and an even smaller list of plays specifically written for autistic actors to perform. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, based on the best-selling novel by Mark Haddon, has been hugely important for representing autism in the theater, even though both Haddon and the adapting playwright, Simon Stevens, choose not to give the main character an official diagnosis.
My name is Christopher John Francis Boone. I live at 36 Randolph Street, Swindon. I like maths, outer space, looking after Toby, and I see everything.
I loved this play for a lot of reasons, but not because I saw myself in the character of Christopher. I knew the play was about autism, but at the time, I did not know that I was autistic.
Definitely know this car. It's 1949 Buick Roadmaster, straight 8, Fireball 8, only 8,095 production models.
I certainly didn't see myself in Rain Man, the 1988 film starring Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise. That movie was probably my first introduction to autism, or maybe it was an ABC after-school special. The point is, none of the depictions of autistic characters in mainstream media looked like me at all.
I'm a weirdo. That's what everyone says. Sometimes I don't know what people mean when they say things.
Things have changed a bit in recent years. Shows like Atypical on Netflix and The A Word from the BBC have done a lot to educate the public about autism. But they are definitely not the last word.
Geek. Noun. An obsessive enthusiast.
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
And then there are the shows that deal with neurodiversity on the down low, like The Big Bang Theory and Geek Girl.
My name is Harriet Manis, and I am a geek.
Bill Prady, who co-created Big Bang with Chuck Lorre, is on the spectrum, and so is Holly Smail, who wrote the original Geek Girl novel. They're open about it in their real lives, but make a choice not to label their characters as autistic.
This is a story for anyone who's ever wanted to fit in. Sometimes to change your life, you have to stand out.
An artistic choice, and maybe a political one, too. Let's get back to my conversation with Sapience playwright Diana Burbano.
You talked about, you know, a Black actor might want a Black Willie Loman. Well, Black actors have many Willie Lomans, thanks to August Wilson.
Yes.
But if you look at the cast lists for August Wilson plays, it's 95% male. So here we have intersectionalism again. What is right and wrong is always somewhere in the middle, and we fight over the small space.
Yeah, of course.
As if it were, you know, an uncrossable chasm.
So much of it comes from people who've been so wounded. I mean, there's nobody more wounded than an actor, and it's vicious out there to put your body up in front, and you are your product, and then you get rejected, and you don't know why you get rejected, and then you see who gets cast, and you said, oh, they wanted this and they didn't want that. I mean, I think the reason it gets so heated is because there is so little. Representation is just such a kind of a strange word for it. I think people just want to see their stories on stage. They want to see themselves on stage. They want to see people they can recognize of themselves on stage. It's not universality, it's specificity. I think real specificity becomes fascinating, and that's where you start making connections with characters who are unlike you, because you realize that you both eat your grandma's food and, you know, go to school and suffer from the same abuse from a bully. And there's just things, there are points that everybody can connect with. I want people to look at people who are different than themselves and understand that everybody's trying the best they can to communicate with each other and to make themselves understood. And even if they don't necessarily know anybody, think they know anybody on the autism spectrum, that they might recognize something and maybe come with a new understanding and kindness to somebody who they previously just were baffled by.
We are living in a very difficult time for the arts, for politics. And I'm wondering if you could talk about, from a, you know, I guess the high altitude level of being an artist, and the responsibility of being an artist in hard times.
Well, I have a belly full of fear, and also I feel, I wanted to hide my head under a blanket for a while, but now I hope I'm back to being able to write about it. But, you know, starting to write a play and then having history sort of start catching up to what you're doing and sort of moving past what you're doing is sort of a wild phenomenon, which I experienced during the first administration. I did a lot of protest writing then. It does feel more dangerous now. It feels more exposed. It just the fact that both race and gender have been called out as you know, topics that for example, the NEA cannot fund. That's new. It's blatant. It's out there, and it feels dangerous. It feels dangerous to be an immigrant. I keep wondering whether my citizenship papers are going to get revoked. You know, but on the other hand, I'm angry, and all I have is my pen, and that's what I'm going to use. And I'm going to. I was interested that he got so interested in the Kennedy Center and into theater. Like, why are they into theater? Theater is such a small sort of portion of the this country's culture, but it's because it's the most critical place. It's the most explosive place. It's where we're really working on diversity, and we're doing the best we can to challenge and shift. And I think that's exciting that it's so dangerous and so controversial. I mean, if a little play about a sparkly shark can freak them out so much that they get rid of the entire, you know, board of directors at the Kennedy Center, well, what hell? Why not?
I said this in a video I did a couple of years ago, never doubt the power of art to change the world, because if art had no power, the powerful wouldn't need to censor it.
Right.
And they always do and try. Like, that's, yes, to control the power of naming. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons someone like Chuck Lorre might not want to name autism in Young Sheldon is if you name that thing, you're also bringing along all the baggage. Mm-hmm. And specifically, you're bringing along DSM-5. Specifically, right? Like you mm-hmm. are, and I did it in my introduction. I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, but what autism spectrum disorder is, that's contested territory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
It is always this battle, war of words, you know?
Yeah.
Am I disabled? Am I neurodivergent? Can I be both? Should I be both? Those are not easy questions to answer, and I guess, you know, they shouldn't be.
Right. You know,
they shouldn't be.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room diametrically opposed foes.
Thank you so much for your time. Break legs, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
System he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade.
You have been listening to Neuroemergent, the podcast about neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by Lonesome George Productions, in partnership with KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KMUZ Community Radio in Salem.
Our theme music was composed by Doug Lengel, and I'm your host, Carrie Stewart Lengel. Join me on the fourth Wednesday of every month from 11 a.m. to noon on KBOO Community Radio.
I lived in a place called Ofuskee, and I had a little girl in a holler tree. I said, little girl, it's plain to see, ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. She said, it's hard for me to see how one little boy got so ugly. Yes, my little girlie, that might be, but there ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key, way over yonder in the minor key, there ain't nobody that can sing like me. We walked down by the Buckeye Creek to see the froggy, the goggle-eyed bee, to hear that west wind whistle to the east. There ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. Oh, my little girlie, will you let me see way over yonder where the wind blows free? Nobody can see in our holler tree, and there ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key, way over yonder in the minor key, there ain't nobody that can sing.
sing like me. Cut a switch from a cherry tree and laid it on to she and me. She stung lots worse than a hive of bees, but there ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Now I've walked a long, long way. Still look back to my Tanglewood days. I've led lots of girls since then to stray. Saying ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me.
listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7